Welcome to the Practical Neurology Podcast, the essential guide for neurologists. Today's discussion from the large choice of excellent case reports in this issue is going to focus on two cases, as always. I'm Martin Turner, a neurologist based in the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, and I'll be guiding the conversation today with our two discussants, Ruth Wood.
Hi, I'm Ruth. I'm a neurology registrar, currently on maternity leave from Sussex.
And Sinew.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sinew. I'm a neurology specialist registrar here in Oxford.
Great. Well, thanks both again for your preparation time and discussion here. And before we present the two cases, a reminder to our listeners, we have two podcasts that are linked to the latest edition of the Practical Neurology Journal. And these are already available, the Editor's Highlights discussion with Phil Smith and Geraint Fuller, and also the Editor's Choice paper interview, as always, brilliantly conducted by Amy Ross Russell. So please subscribe on your favourite platform to get notified every time we publish a new podcast. And then we'll go in with today's case. I think, Sinew, you're going to start us off. So why don't you tell us how this case came to light, please?
Yes, thanks very much. So for the first case, we have a report by Kelly and colleagues based out of the Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital in Western Australia, and they report on a man with increasing seizures and jerks. So this case describes a young man from Pakistan who was referred to neurology clinic back in 2017 with a generalized tonic-clonic seizure. He had three further seizures, as well as episodes of brief collapse with myoclonus while playing cricket, and he described brief involuntary body jerks, especially when exposed to bright light. Another feature is a tremor, which he has had since the age of 12 and has worsened since then. And we also have some background information, as he was born in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province in Pakistan and was the second of six children. We have a little bit about his development. He was a term delivery following an uncomplicated pregnancy. They describe that he has a brother, age 30, who also developed generalized tonic-clonic seizures with limb jerks and gait disturbance, as well as intellectual impairment. And of note, there is some documented consanguinity within his family. We have a bit of his examination when he first comes to clinic, and this described cognitive slowing with normal vision and language. There was some perioral and limb action myoclonus, as well as spontaneous myoclonus involving the trunk, proximal and upper limbs, and head. No stimulus-sensitive myoclonus was described. His reflexes were brisk, with normal tone and strength, no cerebellar issues, but some slowness with rapid alternating movements. His gait was unsteady, more due to this action myoclonus when walking, although he could heel-toe walk. And one final description they give is on imitating the bowling action in cricket, he was uncertain and had to stop mid-ball as he was about to fall.
Okay, thanks, Sinew, for that. So within the history, we've obviously got an initial sense that there's some myoclonus happening here. And I was always taught to ask young people about what happens at breakfast and whether they, you know, have noticed that they suddenly sort of spill things, or I've had people tell me they've thrown cutlery across the room and this sort of thing. So we've definitely got some particularly situation-specific events here, haven't we? And curiously, when bowling and cricket, and then it's almost triggered like a reflex epilepsy when he does that in clinic. What did you make of that?
Yeah, so I thought it was really interesting. We have a young man who presents with these multiple convulsive seizures, but also these prominent body and limb jerks in between the seizures with this trigger of bright light. And you wonder whether this imitation of the bowling is also some sort of other trigger. And I think the history of the sibling with similar symptoms and the consanguinity is quite key, isn't it? And I think on your line of thought, the first condition I would consider is a juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, which is this genetic generalized epilepsy characterized by these myoclonic jerks, often early in the morning, after some form of physiological stress, such as sleep deprivation or alcohol consumption. And people with JME can develop convulsive seizures as well. and a proportion of them, I think around 30 to 40%, exhibit some photosensitivity with these flashing lights, sunlight, TV. So I think about that in this case. However, there are a few atypical features, including this cognitive involvement. I think you have subtle cognitive changes in Jeremy, but not quite this frank. And so I may sort of keep going down this line of thought of progressive type of myoclonic epilepsies, of which there are a list of them, I suppose. But I'd certainly want to get more investigations at this stage.
Yeah, I think it's reasonable, though, to, at this point, let's talk about that list, because it's a sort of very staple question of grand rounds that I've been to in my life, where people ask you to list the progressive myoclonic epilepsies. It's a fairly short list, but it's quite a useful one to know. So over to you, Sinew. Tell us what we should be thinking of.
Yeah, so I was thinking about this and how to approach sort of epileptic myoclonus syndromes. And I think this progressive myoclonic epilepsies form a big part of this list. But if I were just to take a step back first, I think the main way that I would frame epilepsy with prominent myoclonus is along two axes. So firstly, the age of onset of when myoclonus and seizures would occur, and then the severity. And in terms of the age of onset, you can start with infancy, then childhood, then later on in life. And if I were just to list a few according to that axis, in early infancy, you get things like benign neonatal seizures, which can have myoclonic components, but often just go away. But you can have more severe myoclonic type seizures in early infancy. So there's this condition called early infantile epileptic encephalopathy, also known as Ohtahara syndrome. And these can be quite severe. And then later on in infancy, you can again have benign myoclonic epilepsy in infancy. This tends to occur in first year of life and are generally self-limiting, actually. But in infancy, you're more worried about a progressive severe myoclonic epilepsy, also known as Dravet syndrome, due to a mutation in the SCN1A gene. And here you can have seizures associated to a febrile event and then multiple seizures, including myoclonus after that. And as we then filter through sort of later childhood, you can have epilepsy of myoclonic atonic seizures, also known as DOSA syndrome. And these occur late infancy or early childhood with seizures of myoclonus and this characteristic drop or loss of tone. Finally, I would just say that the juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, which I mentioned earlier, which starts more in the teenage years, but can occur later as well. And there is that characteristic EEG finding of generalized 4 to 6 hertz polyspike waves. And going on from there, I would then think of progressive myoclonic epilepsy, which in my mind comes onto the more severe type of myoclonic epilepsies. And this is a real mixed category of heterogeneous conditions associated with usually lysosomal or mitochondrial defects. And if I were to come up with a list, I suppose I'd have a few in my mind, although I wouldn't really expect people to remember everything. But maybe if I just go through it and give you some pointers that would clue listeners to think about progressive myoclonic epilepsies. So this list would include neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis, which is a group of genetic disorders associated with formation of toxic endolysosomal storage, mainly affecting the brain and the retina. You have, so this group also can be abbreviated to the NCLs, can occur in early childhood or in teenage years. And there are multiple types, mostly autosomal recessive. And a classic feature is that they're accompanied by macular degeneration. And one characteristic of NCLs is exaggerated photic stimulus to low frequency stimulation. Next, you have Undvik-Lundborg syndrome, also known as Baltic myoclonus, onset in school age or teenage years, prominent stimulus-sensitive myoclonus, which in this case was described as not being present. This is also an autosomal recessive condition, and the gene is the EPM1 gene.
I think that originally that was referred to as Baltic myoclonus, and then there was a Mediterranean version as well, and then unsurprisingly, they were both found to link to the same gene.
Yep, I think that's right. And a few others I would just remember would be LaFoya disease, again, a progressive myoclonic epilepsy onset in teenage years. This is a ribosomal encoding gene defect, also autosomal recessive, and there will be these classic LaFoya bodies seen on skin biopsy. And then you have myoclonic epilepsy with red ragged fibers, For some reason, I do enjoy saying that. This is a mitochondrial disease where you get ragged red fibers on muscle biopsy. So these are clumps of diseased mitochondria along the edges of the muscle cells, best seen on a Gomori trichrome stain. And these patients will bring in the other gamut of mitochondrial features such as myopathy, in addition to the myoclonus, perhaps short stature, hearing loss, optic atrophy, to hopefully clue you in that this could be a mitochondrial process. And lastly, I just mentioned sialidosis, which again is autosomal dominant. And the classic textbook finding is this cherry red spot in the retina, along with potentially dysmorphic features. And this is a lysosomal disorder. And there are probably a few others that I could mention, but this is a basic list that perhaps listeners can be aware of and structure their thinking about for the grand round, perhaps.
Well, that's a tour de force there, Sindhu, and I'm glad that you did that, because I think I'd have struggled to remember those things. Maybe another time we'll come back to the other causes of a cherry red spot at the macula. Answers on a postcard. But meanwhile, we'll carry on with this case. We're all about the practical neurology. So we've got this young man, we've got these features, we've had a complex list of different possibilities, a lot of which are we'd have expected to have presented perhaps much younger. So we've limited a little bit by the later onset ones. How would we approach the investigation at this stage? What would we do next?
So several investigations were performed, such as blood tests, and these were largely normal. And this included normal glucose, HbA1c, electrolytes, copper, ceruloplasmin, celiac, serology, HIV, very long-chain fatty acids. The report described testing for mitochondrial disorders as well as a leukodystrophy panel, which was negative. The investigators got structural brain imaging in the form of an MRI, which showed abnormal periventricular T2 hyperintensities in the splenium of the corpus callosum, parietal and occipital lobes, so this posterior predilection. And interestingly, they describe this to reflect a possible posterior predominant leukodystrophy.
Do you think that the MRI here was, in retrospect, was a bit of a distractor? Would we have expected to see MRI changes with the sort of conditions you'd mentioned in the previous list?
I think it was a distractor, and they described it as so. You don't typically get very prominent imaging changes in some of the conditions, but in others you can do. But this sort of subcortical picture was more of a leukodystrophy type, and I think it led them to performing more investigations or different investigations than you might for some other forms of myoclonic epilepsy.
Yeah. And then take us through the EEG, because I think there were some features there, weren't there, that were strong clues.
Yeah, so the authors described the EEG as particularly informative, as this showed generalized posterior predominant epileptiform abnormalities, including eye closure-related polyspikes, so a real sort of visual evoked response. And during photic stimulation, there were photoparoxysmal responses, including at low frequencies, which were occasionally associated with myoclonus. So this is really quite interesting to see on an EEG, and photoparoxysmal responses may indicate epileptiform discharges, and these are provoked by flickering lights of different frequencies. Although I have to say, from a more personal note, I've been getting lots of reports back from my own EEGs with this term photoparoxysmal responses, which has led me to look into it a little bit more. And actually, some form of this could be present in even up to 5 to 10% of individuals who do not have epilepsy. So as you can imagine, there's grading systems for how you can try to decide how pathological these responses are. And a very brief description is that if you have more occipital region responses, which are sort of simple spikes that don't spread, they tend to be perhaps less related to an underlying epilepsy. But as you go and have more frontal spreads, more generalized spike wave or polyspike waves, then this tends to think of a more clear link to epilepsy.
It's a good point about the photosensitive aspect, because of course in popular kind of parlance, really, people often assume that individuals with epilepsy will be sensitive to flashing lights, and you get warned about it on the TV and this sort of thing. And it's important, really, if it's something that's coming up, you know, potentially as a normal change that you might see on EEG, to be very clear about what's being described and objective about it. And here, I think right from the start, there was definitely reported worsening in that sort of setting. Have you got any feel for that as a sort of reported symptom in people who come with suspected seizures, you know, in the general clinic, when they report photosensitivity? Is it something that you note, you know, what would make you take that more sort of take more notice of that?
Yeah, so I think there are some EEG characteristics that would make me think that this is perhaps more pathological. As I said, this more frontal spread and more clear polyspike waves. And I suppose from the history as well, how closely related the seizures were to perhaps some stimulating lights. What I would say is I often get reports like this, and they rarely turn out to be photosensitivity. But what I tend to do is I speak to the physiologist and say, can we do a more prolonged test into this? But a useful practical tip for listeners is that I do also caution my patients that should this be the case, there is a risk of having a seizure or having seizure activity. So there is a risk there. But a very practical tip is actually if you close one eye in the situation of flickering lights, so whether that's either in the testing setting or if you go out to a club, that really dampens down the photoparoxysmal response. And so if patients are worried, you can tell them to close one eye, and that should avoid any stimulation from that point of view.
That's enormously helpful. That's a really good tip. And it is important to try and target our advice really to people who are, you know, going to be at most risk. Great. Okay. So there's some clear changes here. And do you think we've got enough at this stage from your original list to go for one of the things on the list? Obviously, we know what the answer is, but do you think it would have narrowed it down completely just on those EEG findings and the age of the patient and the history?
So I think the important clue that was given so far is the EEG finding of a photoparoxysmal response at a very low frequency. So they describe 5 hertz, and this is actually quite rare and is associated with a smaller group of conditions, including ones that we talked about. So the progressive myoclonic epilepsy in the form of neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis, as well as Lafora body disease, is associated with this low frequency response. And I think that really clued the authors onto this being a progressive myoclonic epilepsy rather than a leukodystrophy.
And did they go for a skin biopsy or did they proceed straight to a genetic screen?
So they didn't go for the skin biopsy. They did get the answer from a genetic screen. They also performed a few other investigations, such as a somatosensory evoked potential and nerve conduction studies. And this demonstrated a giant median somatosensory evoked potential with median loop reflexes, which, to be honest, I hadn't quite been familiar with before reading this paper, but it suggests cortical hyperexcitability.
And is that a particular, is the cortical hyperexcitability particularly seen in this condition? I would have thought that we might see that in all sorts of other epilepsy disorders and potentially other neurodegenerative disorders, but is it felt to be very specific?
I don't think it's very specific, but I think the authors at one point had a discussion between a leukodystrophy and an epilepsy or a progressive myoclonic epilepsy, and this helped point them into one direction. It's an interesting point, though, whether you'd find this in neurodegenerative disease. I'm not sure if that would necessarily be the case, but yes, you might see that.
Well, we you know, cortical excitability definitely increases in the affected ALS patients, and it's actually something that may rise just before symptoms begin in small studies that have been done in genetic carriers. So it is quite characteristic there. I think actually in other neurodegenerative disorders, cortical excitability isn't quite so prominent, but it's an interesting point. Certainly I'm not aware of any studies that were done looking at EPs in ALS patients. Okay, so we now have, certainly in the UK, we have a sort of whole genome screening program, don't we? And you can select particular panels. And so I'm pretty confident that within the juvenile to adult onset seizures, these would all be included. And there's a huge number of NCL genes, aren't there? And what did this turn out to be?
So they obtained the diagnosis through genetic testing using an epilepsy gene panel, as you said, and this identified a homozygous missense variant in the CLN6 gene on chromosome 15, indicative of a Cuff's disease type A. So this is effectively a neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis, and Cuff's is the eponymous term for an adult onset NCL, whereas by contrast, Batten's disease is the term for infant or early juvenile onset NCLs.
Okay. Ruth, I haven't come to you as yet, but you know, this was a complicated case, wasn't it? And did you take any particular practice points away?
I think it was useful just going through the thought process of what can cause myoclonus, and particularly epileptic myoclonus. And I think I'll find Zinyu's approach with the two axes really useful when I'm framing that in the future. So yeah, and I think looking for specific signs in the neurophysiology to really point you towards a particular diagnosis, I found that quite interesting to read about. And I'd recommend that readers looked at, I think it was table one in this paper, which had some good clinical clues as well to look for in the different syndromes that might just point you towards an underlying cause of a progressive myoclonus epilepsy as well.
Yeah, I've learned a lot as well from talking to paediatric neurologists. We're very lucky in Oxford at our Grand Round. We involve them, they bring cases, and so you actually get to hear about how some of these conditions present much earlier on, and you know, in a different way than we would expect to see as adult neurologists. And it gives you a little bit more more sort of understanding, which may come out, of course, in a family history. Great. Okay. Well, thanks, Sinew. Difficult case, and a lot to learn from that. So thanks. So we'll move on to the second one. So Ruth, tell us how your case presented.
So this is a case, again, we're going a bit international, I think, this episode. So we've had a case from Australia. This one's from France, from Eva Diab and colleagues. And they describe a case of a 69-year-old lady who was admitted for investigations as a gastroenterology inpatient because she had some persistent abdominal pain. And it was then that she became unwell during this admission and came to the attention of the neurologists. So she had a past medical history of insulin-dependent type 2 diabetes with some dyslipidemia, and she'd experienced some depression and anxiety following the death of her husband. But we're told she has no history of cognitive impairment, and she's retired but leads an independent, normal lifestyle. She'd been admitted for a CT abdomen, gastroscopy and colonoscopy, which were all relatively normal, aside from the finding of some uncomplicated diverticulosis. But the day after she had her gastroscopy, she had what we believe is the first ever tonic-clonic seizure. And that was followed by a persistent weakness in her left upper limb. And at that stage, I believe the neurologists were called in.
Yeah. And just to talk us through the brain scan, because I think that was an obvious thing to do when someone's had their first seizure. And this was all happening really as a gastroenterology ward consult, I guess. So let's talk through the MRI scan and then let's see what we would have thought at that stage.
So yes, I did an MRI scan of her brain, and on a flare sequence, they saw some non-enhancing hyperintensities in the temporal horn of the left lateral ventricle, in the right corona radiata, and there was also an enhancing area in the pons around the area postrema. And this was reported as being suggestive of demyelination.
Okay, well, Sinew, at this stage, I've got someone who came in to investigate some chronic symptoms. Nothing much was found in terms of the gastroenterology investigations, but then they had a seizure after a gastroscopy, and the MRI's got multifocal white matter lesions. So in very broad terms, what would you be thinking about there?
I think trying to put this case together, my thoughts were seizures or neurological symptoms with abdominal pain. So I suppose there are a few conditions or syndromes that I might think about. And the first would be some form of you know, broadly speaking, abdominal epilepsy, but this is seen more in children and characterized by gastrointestinal upset, which are actually the manifestation of the seizures. And case reports kind of localize this to be a temporal lobe seizure semiology. I don't think this would be the case here. Other things to think about would be things like porphyria, which can cause neurological features in abdominal pain. Whipple's disease is linked to the abdominal system, as well as CNS involvement. And if there are some mitochondrial disorders as well, which can involve the gastrointestinal and neurological syndrome.
Okay. No, well, we've got four zebras there. So I'm just going to add a horse that I suppose I would have just wondered if she'd been given too much fluid, really, on the gastroenterology ward and had a low sodium and had a seizure after that, really, initially. So we would think in a very basic way first. But I suppose specifically, once you've done the scan and now you've got new lesions, we might be thinking about whether this was somehow a first presentation of an inflammatory disorder, or I guess would we entertain infection? Were there any clues to any of those sort of much more broad kind of thoughts?
I don't think she had a fever documented in the history. And in fact, that's all the history that we've been given. We do get told some examination findings. She had mutism, no apparent motor deficit, but an upgoing left plantar. But there's nothing really in the history to suggest an infective cause. And it did sound like this was the first presentation as well.
Yeah. So, and then we got a clue, really, didn't we, that there were ongoing seizures. So there's obviously some active process here. And they had to add in some more anticonvulsants. And then how did things sort of progress from there?
Yeah, so she was refractory to first and second line therapies for non-convulsive status that they identified on an EEG. So she had to be sedated and transferred to the intensive care unit. And they added in, she was on levetiracetam, carbamazepine and lacosamide in the end before her seizures were adequately controlled. And then even once her seizures were controlled, it was noted that she had disordered sleep and impaired cognitive function. So her MMSE was only 17 out of 30. And her neuropsychology showed that she had a global cognitive impairment, particularly with disturbance of verbal episodic memory and also impaired executive function as well.
So I suppose we would have to just wonder how that sort of fitted in with the seizures, because of course it is difficult to assess people and they can be quite knocked off after they've had a lot of seizures. But I suppose I was struck at this stage, this is someone who, you know, came in really just for the investigation of some rather chronic, fairly average symptoms, and has now sort of catastrophically declined, really, with what we assume are these new cerebral lesions. So it's a very difficult, puzzling condition at this stage. And they did go on, didn't they, to do CSF, and what did that show?
Her CSF showed a raised protein at 0.8 grams per litre. She had four cells and one oligoclonal band, but otherwise the CSF was fairly unremarkable.
What would you take away from, so, you know, it's acellular, so, I mean, we didn't have any infection markers, but that's reassuring as well. Perhaps slightly raised protein, could be inflammatory. What did you make of the oligoclonal band?
They didn't comment on whether there were any matched bands in the serum. I suppose it suggests maybe some intrathecal immunoglobulin synthesis, but there's only one, and it's not a particularly specific finding. The MRI is suggestive of demyelination, so I suppose you could read into that. You know, if you were looking for MS, for example, that oligoclonal bands would be highly significant, but this doesn't really sound like your classic MS case at all.
No, and it would be very unusual, sort of very fulminant first presentation, and obviously quite an older patient. I do sometimes just remember that oligoclonal bands can sometimes be a marker for paraneoplastic disorders. She did go on to have some antibodies, didn't she? Which ones did they do?
They don't tell us, actually. They just say that tumour biomarkers were negative. They did test antineuronal antibodies, and they did an FDG PET, which showed no suspicious lesions. And I suppose thinking back, her CT abdomen appeared normal to the gastroenterologist. So we know that there was no obvious solid tumour on that scan.
Yeah. And the aquaporin 4 negative, MOG negative, HIV negative. So all kind of the sort of standard things that I think we would approach in a patient like this, and actually we would do in a patient with new onset refractory epilepsy, although things do seem to have settled on the seizures. So we're left now with someone who's, we've got on top of their seizures. They've really declined quite a lot, though. I think at this stage, we still think they're on ITU. They'd identified a little bit of liver cirrhosis of undetermined cause, but they thought that was probably non-alcoholic fatty liver. So how did things move forward from there, or how were we put onto a different path?
They did Whipple's PCR in the stools and the saliva, I'm assuming because they had a clinical suspicion, and also in the CSF. And this came back positive in the stools and the saliva, but negative in the CSF. But they weren't deterred by that. And they went on to, she'd already had duodenal biopsies from her gastroscopy, but those were negative for Whipple's. But they actually then did a jejunal biopsy, and the PCR from that was positive for Whipple's, even though the kind of more classic periodic acid shift PAS staining was negative.
Yeah, so they were obviously very kind of driven towards that diagnosis. So I don't know, Sinew, have you have been involved or know of colleagues who've thought about this and worked cases up or even had a positive case?
I can't say I have, to be honest. It's one of those things that we do discuss in Grand Round, but I haven't seen a case personally.
No, I once mentioned Whipple's at a Grand Round, and a now retired neurologist said that Whipple's was the last refuge of the intellectually destitute, which I took as a compliment. It is one of those conditions, really, that you often, you know, have never seen. It's slightly legendary in the sense of you kind of imagine how it might present, but you don't have any reference point to know. And I am curious as to why they obviously were very drawn to that. So tell us, Ruth, in your reading about the literature on Whipple's, what's the sort of case is going to make us think of it? Because I have to say, I'm not sure I would have gone straight for that here. What's the sort of typical case, if there is one?
So I think lots of the cases can present atypically, but the typical presentation is that of a malabsorption syndrome. So patients will have diarrhea, abdominal pain, weight loss, and these symptoms might be preceded by a migratory arthralgia. And that can actually occur several years before other symptoms develop. And in terms of neurological involvement, patients, I think about 1 in 5 have CNS involvement. And there's meant to be this typical triad of cognitive impairment, vertical gaze palsy, and myoclonus. So none of these features were really present in this patient apart from the abdominal pain.
And of course, actually, all of the decline, we still can't get away from the fact that it happened really rapidly and acutely. We hadn't had a story in the past. Did you find anything in reading or other cases of perhaps a concept where it could be triggered or decompensated somehow? Maybe this coming into hospital, having procedures somehow triggered something?
I didn't find any other cases like that, but I did find it interesting that I think estimates are between 1 and 10% of the population in certain countries might actually be colonized with the bacteria that causes the disease. But the disease itself is so rare, and actually it might be a defective host immune response, it's postulated, that means that disease manifests in some people, not in others. And people think maybe immunosuppression might have a role, although that hasn't been proven. So I don't know, you know, whether if you're having an invasive gastro procedure, whether somehow the bacteria you're colonised with enters the bloodstream, or I don't know.
Yeah, it's a really good thought, actually. I mean, yeah, you would definitely wonder about that. I was just checking. She did have an invasive, gastroscopy, not just CT. So that is a good thought. But I suppose equally slightly concerning that you may get a positive PCR, I guess, if you just got the bug there as a sort of a normal coloniser. Especially if we're thinking about people in a clinic who might come to our neurology clinic, you mentioned if they sort of talked a lot about arthralgia, would we be swayed or interested if they had prominent sort of gastrointestinal symptoms, or is that actually not something that we should overinterpret or necessarily expect to see?
From what I've read, you should look to exclude the more common causes of the gastrointestinal symptoms first. So it really is, you know, looking into the more common causes like inflammatory bowel disease, which can cause gastrointestinal symptoms and joint pain, before leaping on to investigating for Whipple's. And lots of people, I think, who are asymptomatic and don't have any gastrointestinal symptoms will still have the diagnosis made on a small bowel biopsy. So I don't think you can really hang too much on the GI symptoms in clinic, to be honest.
No, and I wonder whether it'd be interesting to talk to our gastroenterology colleagues and see whether this is a condition that they think of, that they feel, that they see. We often find, don't we, with there are certain conditions that rheumatologists, they present a different way to rheumatologists than they present to neurologists. And we realise that we think completely differently. I always think that some of the vasculitides, the rheumatologists feel very differently about how they present compared to us, and even in the management of them initially. So, and then tell us about the sort of more acutely unwell patient like this with seizures and cognitive decline that we might get called to see in hospital. Would we be primarily driven by MRI findings? Would it be the refractory seizures? Would it be the cognitive features? Is there anything that we can, you know, feel that would make us think, okay, now we need to start thinking about Whipple's?
There are no typical MRI findings, so those are relatively non-specific. I think if you had a patient with a fairly rapid progressive cognitive impairment and your standard cognitive screen had not thrown anything up, it would be reasonable to then think about Whipple's. The symptoms, I think one of the further reading papers recommended in this article, there were 32 potential neurological symptoms listed associated with Whipple's. But I think the most common to sort of look out for is this vertical gaze palsy. It can involve the hypothalamus, which can cause sleep disturbances, and SIADH. And then there's this pathognomic sign that you might want to look out for, oculomasticatory myorrhythmia, which is described, and it's this pendular convergent divergent oscillation of the eyes, and that occurs in synchrony with involuntary contractions of the muscles of mastication. And that's not really thought to be seen in anything else, but I think it only occurs in about 25% of cases of CNS Whipple's.
Yes, that's it's always said to be pathognomonic, isn't it, which is always dangerous. I think most things that have been said to be pathognomic, as we've got more molecular information, we've sort of moved away from that. But yeah, I think there are videos that you can find to see what that looks like. I would also just point readers to there is a Practical Neurology article by Peter Panagiotis, who wrote up a few cases in Practical Neurology in 2008. And it's actually there's a very interesting set of tables there, really, on what features the patients had. I mean, hemiparesis is mentioned really in half the patients in that series, along with cognitive dysfunction, seizures quite high, eye movement abnormalities, sleep disorders. And then coming down the list, really, the sort of really just SIADH in only one of the 17 cases, and only one with the ocular masticatory myorrhythmia. So a very difficult diagnosis to make, really. And I suppose with the PCR, that's relatively straightforward to do on CSF, which you would have taken anyway. It does seem that the biopsies of the bowel are not that reliable. And of course, they're more difficult to get anyway. Do you get a sense, if you think about this diagnosis, you go for the PCR on the CSF and it's negative, would it be reasonable then to stop there, or how far would you have to go?
Well, in this paper, they said that the CSF PCR could be negative in up to half of cases. So repeating it's worthwhile, because I think you then pick up a further 25%. And from my reading sort of outside of this paper, I think if you're suspecting it, you really do have to do a small bowel biopsy, even though it's invasive, because PCR on that sample rather than the PAS staining is one of the gold standard ways of diagnosing it. I also found it really interesting that you can do the PCR in almost any sample from the body, but sterile samples tend to be a lot more specific, and things like stool and saliva and urine lack sensitivity. So it's important to be aware of that, because you could just pick up asymptomatic carriers if you're relying on that as your only test.
Yeah. And it's quite a big commitment, isn't it, the antibiotics? So talk us through what you have to give.
There's no consensus on this, but people usually start by giving ceftriaxone initially for 2 weeks, and then it might be extended for up to 4 weeks if there's CNS disease. And then after that, patients are on antibiotics for a further year. This patient had trimethoprim and sulfamethoxazole for a year, but sometimes that's extended up to 2 years. And relapse is quite common when antibiotics are stopped. And there's been some suggestion that maybe hydroxychloroquine and doxycycline might actually be better for maintenance treatment. But I think there's an RCT going on at the moment, so hopefully answer that question. Although how they identify enough patients for that, I'm not sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a difficult study to power, isn't it? And of course, I guess there must be complications of disrupting people's bowel flora with antibiotics for that long, and obviously clostridium and other complications. So how did this patient do with their antibiotics? Did they get better?
Well, she had no further seizures over 2 years of follow-up, but they had started 3 anti-epileptic medications. And unfortunately, her cognitive function didn't improve to her pre-morbid baseline. She had an MMSE of 22 out of 30, so slight improvement from the nadir. And then sadly, she died 2 years after her admission. We're told from liver and cardiac dysfunction, but it's unclear whether that was related to the Whipples or from separate disease.
Yeah, and actually in those cases that were in the earlier article in Practical Neurology in 2008, half of those cases died despite antibiotic therapy. So it is a difficult condition, not only to diagnose, but then even to intervene on. I have to say, I left, having read through this with many, many more questions really about the case, and still disturbed me really why it all seemed to suddenly deteriorate in hospital. And I'm not sure that it would have been something that I would have thought of if they'd come to clinic, although at that stage they didn't have any neurological symptoms. Sinew, what have you taken away from this?
Yeah, I think the diagnostic complexity was something which was quite jarring. I agree that if you have a negative CSF, I think often people may stop there when investigating a neurological condition, but to then go on and do biopsies of the small bowel and not just the duodenum, but to go back and get jejunal biopsies as well, I think it's a massive commitment, and I'm not sure how much I would have pushed for that, but I guess from reading this paper, it looks like we almost have to if we are committed to excluding Whipples as a diagnosis. So quite a conundrum, I think.
Yeah, it would be good if there was some way that we could sort of notify with this condition, really, to try and understand it a bit more. Certainly the Association of British Neurologists has a rare diseases ascertainment and recruitment radar where it is possible to list very rare conditions, and then when people have a case, they can log it, and then we can learn more from that. I have to say, I'm not sure I even can think of a colleague who's had a confirmed case of Whipples, so it's in that sort of territory really where it leaves us feeling rather uncertain. Great, well, really good to discuss that. And lots to think about. So thank you very much for taking us through that. So we've had 2 great cases among many other cases. So do have a look in this issue at all the other great cases that are there. For those of you listening, do leave feedback if you think there are ways we could improve this or any of the Practical Neurology podcasts. If you get the chance, have a listen to those other ones and the past issues. They're all available on Spotify, on Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks ever so much for listening, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time.